This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at the Justice Department's crackdown on gangs and what one group in Chicago is doing to present young people with options.
There are some 5,000 gang members in Chicago, people with really no future. The reasons for it are obvious. Let's talk to somebody who's trying to do something about it.
Attorney Jim Lafferty, longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild and a radio co-host in his own right, joins us to discuss his thoughts on the Trump administration.
What's the resistance accomplished so far? Where do we go from here? Jim Lafferty has some thoughts on that.
As part of our Lawyers You'll Like segment, we'll talk with attorney Paul Gatone from Tucson, Arizona. For over two decades, Paul has been a staunch defender of civil liberties and criminal defense. And he also runs a bookstore called Revolutionary Grounds. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, I don't know if you remember, but the reason I am on Law and Disorder was that I was a guest of Jim Lafferty's The National Lawyers Guild radio show over a decade ago. You happened to hear the segment, and you called and invited me to join you on this program.
Yeah, and the rest is history, Heidi. And now we have Jim Lafferty in the studio as a guest co-host.
One of our favorite hosts in the nation.
Yeah, Jim runs the Lawyers Guild show in L.A., has for the last 25 years. And we're happy to have him here working with us today.
With my children. I feel like the father of this show in some ways.
You are right. Our guru.
Well, KPFK is the sister station.
It is indeed.
Of WBAI in New York. We've been inspiring each other for all these years, and today we'll get a chance to talk to some very interesting people.
As you always do, and I appreciate the chance to join you in doing that.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions recently vowed that the Justice Department has zero tolerance for gang violence. If you are a gang member, he said, we will find you. We will devastate your networks. We will starve your revenue sources, deplete your ranks, and seize your profits. We will not concede a single block or street corner to your vicious tactics. President Trump then tweeted his approval of Sessions' comments, saying, I promise to get tough, and we are. The administration's efforts to crack down on gangs will mean more arrests and lengthy incarceration for young persons, with little attention paid to alternatives to detention and programs to offer productive and meaningful choices. In Chicago, where gang violence has received a great deal of media attention, one community-based organization has been working in some of the city's toughest neighborhoods to stem violence before it interferes with young people's potential. In 1969, the group Build began working with gang-affiliated teens and now serves nearly 3,000 youth each year, offering targeted services designed to prevent kids from joining gangs, and also working with gang-involved youth to develop alternatives to their lifestyle. Build works with young persons who are in contact with the justice system to provide alternatives to detention and to assist with successful reentry. Joining us today is Build's Manager of Intervention Services, Martin Anguiano. Martin has worked at Build since 1994 and now oversees their services to young persons involved in or at risk for involvement in gangs and the juvenile justice system. Martin holds a BA in psychology from the University of Illinois at Chicago and is trained in trauma-informed practices and certified in peace circle keeping. Martin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us about how many so-called gang members are there in the country.
Ooh, well, in the country, that's a tough one. It's well over 10,000 easy. Just in Chicago, there's probably there's more than 5,000. I don't know the exact total, but I know that it's very high.
Can you tell us, why do you think young people join gangs? Is it to belong or to recreate a sense of family?
Well, there's several reasons why young people join gangs. One, it's generational. Sometimes their mom or their dad was a gang leader, and then it goes down to their son, and then it's just like a circle. So in a lot of cases, especially with us, you know, we've seen that where the young people, they're in gang because their dad was a gang member, was a gang leader, and now he's part of that same gang, and then it just keeps going on to different generations. So that's one. And then another one is a lot of times it's just a sense of belonging. You know, young people might not have a parent that is there for them at home, and, you know, might, for several reasons. One, might be working all day, or is involved in drugs, or just doesn't care about the young person. So the young people, they come out, and then they find they want to belong to something. And so the gang members out there, they notice somebody when they're down, and they try to that's how they recruit them. They give them, like, false sense of belonging. Like, they give them, they let them know, like, hey, we have money for you. You want to make quick money. You want some new shoes. And, you know, so these young people do it. And then the third one is just protection. Maybe a young person was going to school and he got jumped on by a gang member, or he's getting picked on at school. That's for somebody that's not a gang member. So, you know, the person might be scared and, you know, join a gang, and that way he has protection. He or she has protection. So, I mean, there's several ways.
Yeah. Hi, Martin. Jim Lafferty. Sure. First of all, I appreciate your work. I'm familiar with the similar kind of work in Los Angeles, and I know how vitally important and helpful it can be. There was mention at the top of the show about targeted services that you provide. For example, I know one of the problems often with gang members after the fact, so-called gang members, are the tattoos. So there's a program in Los Angeles whereby they help the former member get rid of their tattoos. Employment skills are taught. There's a bakery that has been set up that is run by former members of so-called gangs. There's a wonderful cafe that I've eaten at, in fact, with the chief of police of Los Angeles, that is run by former girl members of so-called gangs. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if their employment skills or other kinds of things you do to help these former so-called gang members.
Yes, well, we work with different organizations that actually hire felons or young people that are, that have a record, criminal record background. We know that one of the biggest issues while young people are still out there on the streets selling drugs and gangbanging is because they won't get hired by a lot of people because of the background. And so we work with different organizations that help assist with hiring ex-felons. We work with a program called the RISE program. That's called Restoring Individuals Through Supportive Environments. And they actually hire young people between the ages of 16 to 24, where they help them out and just pretty much hire them only, and they teach them life skills. They do a lot of mentoring. They do a lot of one-on-one trainings and learning the different activities with the young people. They do a lot of civic leadership workshops and coping skills, conflict mediation. And so they get paid through that. That's like a stepping stone for the young people. And from there, when they it's a 6-month program. And when they finish that program, they have workers that actually place young people into jobs.
Martin, I had a question. How difficult is it for young people to not join a gang? I mean, you make it sound like they're often enticed with, you know, promises of money and safety. Is there a lot of peer pressure for, like, a shy kid maybe who's, you know, doesn't have that many friends?
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure, especially in certain neighborhoods where gangs and crime is, that's all they see. We service a lot of the neighborhoods we service. It's incredible what these young people have to go through just to get to school. I mean, you leave out of the house and there's drug sales right in front, right in the corner, And then on your way walking to the school, there's nonstop, you see, like, prostitution, or you see, like, all kinds of stuff, like people just hanging out and you know, some gang members that's, you know, trying to recruit young people. So, I mean, it's really tough, and the peer pressure is even more tough because, you know, these guys nonstop. Imagine you're at home and what are you going to do? There's nothing to do outside. I mean, you go outside and there's nothing but gangs and nothing but drug sales going on. And so, you know, who are you going to hang out with unless you go outside of that environment? So we, as an agency, what we do, we provide, like, after-school program. We provide a lot of one-on-one mentoring. We pull those kids from those environments and bring them to our headquarters, or we just go on field trips. You know, we just do a lot of positive things so they won't be out there on the streets.
That's terrific. You know, I'm wondering, the Chicago Police Department, of course, doesn't have the best reputation in the country. Right. I'm wondering what the relationship is and what the attitude is of the Chicago Police Department with respect to the work that you're trying to do. Are they sympathetic to it? Do they work with you? Are they helpful in any way? Or are they just operating still from suspicion and the notion that once someone was in a gang, they're just no good?
Right. Well, we make it a point to really collaborate and with the police and make sure that we're working with them. It's not to say that we're out there trying to, you know, solve cases or anything, but we just want to make, we know that the reputation of the Chicago Police Department is not very good around here, especially with the, you know, certain areas with the black and brown folks. But we try to let them know that, you know, not all the cops are bad. You know, what we do is a lot of events that we have, we invite the police. So we meet with the police and then we have the police interact with the young people and get to know them. So then when they see them on the streets, then they won't be like, okay, that's a criminal, or they're going to try to pick on this guy, or the young people won't look at the police like in a different way because, you know, let's be honest, like, the reputation they have is not the best right now. So,
yes.
But our goal is just to improve that and just let them know, let the young people know that, you know, not all cops are bad, and cops actually do some good stuff. And there's some very good cops that really want to help out and just you know, be friendly with the young people out here. So, yeah.
Martin, the new Attorney General Sessions, backed up by Trump, has made a promise to crack down with extraordinary force on gangs. What do you think of that attitude?
Well, a couple of things. What we try to do as an agency, you know, gangs obviously is not a good thing. Like, we don't condone or we don't support gangs at all. But, you know, not all young people that are even part of gangs are actually, doesn't necessarily mean that they're just, like, real bad people and there's no hope for them. Our goal is to pull those people from those gangs. And I think what makes us successful as an agency is most of our intervention workers, they were former gang leaders. They were used to be out there committing the crimes that these guys are committing. We have guys that we have a young man. Well, he's not young anymore, but he spent 27 years in prison. We have another one 19, another one 12, 13. And the reason why those are good is they're good to work with when it comes to the young people is because they could relate to them. And they could go out there and let them know, like, you know, they're talking from experience. And they try to just mentor the young people. And so, you know, that's the stance that we take when it comes to that.
You need the street credibility, too.
Well, the street credibility, it means a lot, especially with these young people out there, because a lot of times they'll say, well, you don't know what I've been through. You don't know what I'm going through. So why do you, you know, how can you tell me what I'm going through? And so with our guys, you know, they're out there, they're speaking from experience. They know what they're going through. They've done that and more, you know. So now their whole goal is just to keep them from doing what they did, well, you know, what they were doing as far as prison time.
One of the questions I was wondering about, and I think about this often when I think about so-called gangs, and that is their enterprises in a society that doesn't provide them with opportunities to earn a living in any other way very often. These are poor kids who aren't likely to find themselves being able to get into college. There's not enough training, other kinds of training programs that the government provides for them. They're facing, you know, earning $7-$8 an hour at McDonald's, and they say to themselves, "Hell, we could do a lot better than that, selling some pot on the street." So to survive and to support ourselves, right. And so they form these enterprises for the same reason that corporate America forms enterprises. And probably do a hell of a lot less harm, I might add, than many of the corporate American enterprises. But what's the solution to that, so long as we live in a society where there is such a gap between rich and poor, so much discrimination against people of color? Right. I mean, how do we ever get to the point where we don't need your services because there's a different kind of opportunity level that young people growing up face and have?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, one of the things that we do is that we always preach is education. Education is the key. I know it's an old saying, but it's very true. Education is the key to everything, because if you're educated, if you graduate from high school, you have a college degree, you have a career, the odds are you can get a very good job. And so we try to stress a lot education. So some of these guys out there that are on the streets that aren't in school, our goal is to get them in school, make sure that, you know, assist them with the tutoring and get them up to par, because we've had a lot of successes with that. And so what we try to do is we try to reach leadership of the gangs. And then we try to, you know, we use our workers that know the leadership, their influences. So they meet with the leadership, and then they try to, like, that's how they pull the kids and tell them, like, you know, this young person wants out of the gang, and this young person wants, you know, we know that, you know, he's out there, but he doesn't want to be out there, you know, so let's work together so we could try to, you know, we want to get him in school, we want him to be successful in life, because in reality, you know, without education, then you're right, you're not going to do much in life later on. And so that's why these guys are out there in the street selling drugs and just making their money like that. But yeah, it's definitely something that it's a disadvantage. So
yes, all right.
You know, we do a lot of family events where we have, like, basketball tournaments, bingo, arts and crafts, face painting for the youth, and, you know, we try to be out there. And so they want to come in and volunteer, volunteer their time and even money too, if
nice.
Possible.
Right? Nice. And also, how many girls are involved in gangs?
It's not nearly as high with the girls as far as gang members, but what we've noticed is lately there's been a huge increase in crimes committed by girls, and so that's one of the growing things that's happening as far as crime. So the girls are being more violent now than they were before, and it's very disturbing, and that's one of the things that we have to address.
How do you explain that? Can you explain that?
Well, that's a tough one. It's just they're, you know, they go under the radar because, you know, a lot of times the guys are the ones that are doing out the shooting and all this crazy stuff, but the girls are doing a lot of the behind the scenes stuff, setting people up and just going out there and they're doing a lot of those high crimes too, fights, a lot of. You know, it's just, like, kind of out of control with that. Yeah.
Martin, if one of our listeners wants to know more about your program, Build, is there a website that you could suggest they go to?
Yes, they could go to www.buildchicago.org.
Buildchicago.org. Wonderful.
Right.
Well, Martin, it's been a real joy to have you on, and we'd like to stay in touch and keep our listeners up to date on your progress.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you take it easy,
okay.
Martin. Thanks again.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Donald Trump has been in office now for over 100 days. His cabinet and closest advisors constitute a group of generals, multimillionaires, and billionaires. It's the richest cabinet in American history. His closest advisors are members of his family, an organizational setup that more resembles the mafia than past executive office inhabitants. His predecessor, Barack Obama, was a disappointment to many people who supported him 8 years ago. He presided over U.S. wars in the Middle East. His government overthrew the governments of Libya, the Ukraine, and Honduras. Domestically, he failed to prosecute those guilty of torture, which is illegal under American and international law. He failed to close the offshore prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He failed to prosecute the bankers who crashed the American economy in 2008. And he deported more people than any other president in American history. Now, with Donald Trump in office, people are asking the question, is he qualitatively different than Obama? What's the continuity and what's the discontinuity between Obama and the Trump administrations? To discuss the current situation in the United States and the movement that has arisen in response to Trump, we are pleased to welcome back Los Angeles National Lawyers Guild attorney Jim Lafferty. Jim participated as a lawyer during the 1960s civil rights movement in Mississippi. He's a former executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. He was a central leader in the movement against the war in Vietnam. For the last 30 years, Jim has headed up the Los Angeles National Lawyers Guild chapter, growing it into one of the most effective and active chapters in the United States. He is currently the co-host of the Lawyers Guild show on KPFK, the Pacifica station in Los Angeles. Jim is organizing the People's Congress of Resistance.
Jim Lafferty, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Hi, it's wonderful to be here. Whenever I get the chance and I'm in New York and you're kind enough to ask me, I will always say yes.
So we have to ask the question of the day. Jim, what frightens you about Donald Trump?
What doesn't frighten me about Donald Trump would be a question that would be harder to answer. Obviously, everything. I mean, where to begin? I mean, his lack of knowledge. I mean, you know, when he talks about if Jackson could have handled the Civil War, when the Civil War happened after Jackson's death, when he talks about who was it, W.E. Du Bois? I forget who it was, who'd long been dead, and he talked about him as though they were suddenly still with us. The fact that he doesn't read, the fact that he lies without total compunction, he doesn't worry about it at all. His tutor, of course, had been Roy Cohn, who had said to him, just double down on anything you say. Lie, cheat, and steal was basically his advice growing up. So he does. He's stole from all of his workers, and now he's continuing to use the office of the presidency as a money-making endeavor. I'm amazed he isn't still doing what he was doing on the campaign trail and bringing his products to every one of his news conferences or forcing Spicer to do the same. I worry about the fact that he could start a war with Korea. Korea has been a flashpoint in the world for many years now, but the world has not been as nervous about it as they have been. I interviewed on our own show out in California a couple of the authors of the Journal of Atomic Physicists report. This is the first time in the history of that report they've ever mentioned an individual by name as a factor in moving their clock, which they did to 2.5 minutes to midnight. And that person, of course, was Donald Trump. I worry that he's setting such an example. What he's done around the news, for example, if you can't believe in the news anymore, and of course he doesn't want people to believe in the news because only Breitbart and Fox News tells the story his way, you lose respect for journalism. And as public opinion polls already show, the respect for journalism and for the news media in this country is at an all-time low. I worry about the fact that what he's doing, not only in the here and now and rejecting science and rejecting climate change, 4 years of Trump is enough to set us back I don't know how long with respect to any number of the issues we should be moving forward with as opposed to going backwards with.
And I just, on a side note, want to ask you, Jim, sometimes I look at Trump and I see his ruddy red face. He's even admitted, I think recently, this job is more work than I thought. I worry if he might succumb to the pressures of the job and, say, have a heart attack. But in that scenario, we'd be left with Pence. What are your thoughts about, can he make it for the full 4 years? And if not, what would we be looking at?
Well, aren't we in a situation where our alternative is a fool, a liar, a vicious money grubber, or some religious nut who wants to send women back to the Dark Ages, whose politics are in many ways probably to the right of Trump's, and yet who comes across as sane, and therefore might get much more done with the Congress than Trump is able to do, and win more people, more support. You know, recently, Trump helped to preserve Obamacare by the way in which he dealt with the Republicans in the Congress. Pence, I think, would have been a lot smarter about that. And who knows, therefore, what might have happened. So you talk about a Sophie's choice. I mean, it's impossible. I don't want to say it's either one of those guys is just terrible. They don't represent what the majority of people in this country believe. That's one of the ironies. If you do public opinion polling on any of the issues of the day, the country is far, far more liberal than either Pence or the Republican Congress or Trump. But for gerrymandering, but for this, but for the money that the role that money plays in deciding who gets elected, you wouldn't have these vipers sitting there running the country. And they're out of touch with the majority of people in this country who don't have control of their government. We live in an oligarchy, a corporate oligarchy, and this is proof of it if ever we needed to see proof of it.
So, Jim, how do you evaluate the resistance to Trump so far? There have been almost weekly mobilizations. You had everything from scientists pouring out onto the streets to even today in the New York Times reported that his own daughter Ivanka tried to get him to walk back that story about his sexually assaulting women, and he wouldn't do it and reduced her to tears, and she ran out of the room. She's supposed to be a moderating force. We've got tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people out on the street. How do you evaluate all of that, and where do you think we should go from here?
Well, I think it's proof of what I said a moment ago, that the majority of the people in this country really do not back him. And I'm not just talking about the fact that he was 3 million votes short of Hillary Clinton in the actual electoral vote, but beyond that. So it's not surprising that you'd have the largest and most persistent demonstrations in a first 100 days of anybody's presidency that you've ever seen in this country. The repulsion to Trump and everything he stands for has been manifested wonderfully well in the streets. Now, the difficulty with that, of course, is you can't do that every day. Even Trump doesn't give you a reason to do it every day. And the other danger, by the way, is it becomes normalized. Well, that's just Trump. There's no point in reacting to it every time he does something utterly bizarre. And people have to go about their lives. They have jobs and so forth. So you can't expect that. What the movement is going to need for the long haul. But I'm encouraged by it. Don't get me wrong. I'm thrilled by the outpouring we've seen so far. It shows that the resistance is there, that people are prepared to do something. Now, what should they be doing for the long haul? That's something that I don't think anyone has yet figured out. One of the things that I'm currently involved in, and one of the initiators of, is something called the People's Congress of Resistance. It's going to take place on September 15th at Howard University in Washington, D.C. And various political groups and immigrant rights groups and women's rights groups and authors and what have you have endorsed this thing already. It's just gotten off the ground in the last few weeks. We hope to bring together opponents of Trumpism from all across the country for a couple of days in Washington to address that very question of what is our long-term goal and how do we get there, since we can't simply be reflective and responsive. We've got to be proactive. And how do we develop a proactive program for the long haul? That's something the left has needed, I think, in this country for a while. And this Congress is one effort. There'll be others. One effort to come up with the answer to that question.
Jim, as you know, a critical playing block in supporting or reporting on people's movements is the media. And you alluded to your fears about what's happening to that. We've long seen a decline in investigative reporting as our mainstream media has become really a few large corporate conglomerates. I mean, I've noticed in the New York Times, which I read every day, so many really more focused stories investigating various aspects of this new administration. Do you think we're going to see a resurgence of real investigative reporting in response to the so-called claims of fake news?
Yeah, I would hope so. And I've often been a critic of the New York Times, and I think the New York Times has done a surprisingly good job both during the campaign and of late in calling him on his lies and getting the facts out. The print media has laid off. L.A. Times, for example, has 400 or 500 reporters less than it had. The market for that tends to manifest more on the Internet, and the Internet is open to everybody. And it doesn't always show what its sources are, and you don't always know whether there's any truth to the story you've read. These are times that demand more investigative journalism than ever before. There are certainly individuals out there who are doing that. But providing them with a mass of outlet for that, they aren't going to find it on CNN. They aren't going to find it in these diminishing local small town and big city newspapers, other than a few like the Times and the Post and what have you. So journalism schools are going to have to work overtime, I think, to find new ways of encouraging the kind of investigative reporting and, more importantly, finding a way to then get that investigative report out to the community, because the corporate-owned media certainly isn't going to do it.
You know, ultimately, Jim, I think you would agree with me that unless the movement, the left, the majority of people in this country have their own organization, first and foremost, just to defend themselves, if we don't present an alternative poll, I think the country's going to continue to veer more and more to the right. And I wanted your reflections on that.
One of the great disappointments of my life during this recent period of time was Bernie Sanders. He ran in the Democratic primaries. You could argue that maybe that was his only choice if he wanted to be heard, was to run a Democratic Party. But he built up a huge movement of support. And what's he doing now? He's still, as far as I can tell, encouraging people to run for office in the Democratic Party. He told us it was all fixed. He told us what's wrong with the Democratic Party. His politics aren't that of the Democratic Party. We need a new party in this country. We need a people's party, a workers' party, an anti-capitalist party. And that's not going to happen so long as people think they can somehow reform the Democratic Party. Americans for Democratic Action and all sorts of good liberals have for decades now, since I can remember, have been trying to make the Democratic Party into something it not only can't be made into, but it's less likely to be made into today than it was 20 or 30 years ago. It's more owned by corporate. That's why, as you or somebody said at the top of the show, this is the richest, most number of bill in Congress that we've ever seen, Democrat, Republican alike. So we need a new people's movement, and it needs to have a new party. That's one of the things, certainly, that at the People's Congress for Resistance we'll talk about. But that's a big question, a big job, and I'm disappointed that Bernie Sanders isn't lending himself to that effort, frankly.
Yeah, well, Jill Stein said to Bernie Sanders, "I'll step down. You can run as an independent Green Party.
Yeah.
Let's build our own organization."
She was right.
I think he missed his moment in history.
I do, too.
When he didn't take her up on that. Heidi, you had a question.
I do, Jim. I'm interested in your take on comments of some who assert that a certain element of political correctness among the left and sort of trends that we've seen in the last, say, 10 to 15 years actually contributed to Trump's success, in that people feel that an elite few are shifting the way we need to talk to each other.
Yeah, I frankly agree with that. And I'm very alarmed about that. I'm alarmed at what's happening on the college campuses. I'm alarmed at what's going on at Berkeley.
Free speech issues.
I did an editorial on our show a week ago, in which I said, in essence, what the left should have been doing at Berkeley is protecting Colton from angry mobs. They should have put up a cauldron of people to make sure she could get in and give her talk, because if you don't protect free speech for the right, the government is not going to come after the rights, free speech first. They're going to come after, as they are already doing, with laws introduced in 19 or 20 legislations making protests more criminal and so forth. So the notion that you don't protect the right to speak is stupid. And then what goes with that, of course, is a kind of political correctness, which started off making perfect sense and now has gotten to the point where it's so narrow that people feel that unless I'm prepared to accept the fact that there are 40 nouns for gender, I guess I can't be part of this movement. I'm worried about that.
And that brings me to a related question. In fighting on the left,
yes,
and what some have criticized as many groups or leaders not being able to be part of a coalition if they don't agree with every single point. There's almost a political purity that has then fragmented the left.
One of the efforts that I've been involved with, Michael here has been involved with, others have been involved with, is trying to overcome what you're talking about. There is no left party in this country today that can take on the most powerful, corrupt capitalist government the world has ever seen by themselves. And yet, while they may differ on all sorts of aspects of Marxism and Leninism and what have you, they certainly can agree that we ought not to go to war in Korea, that we ought to have a $15 or whatever it is living wage all through the country, that there certainly ought to be a single-payer health care plan for everybody, that a woman ought to have a right to have an abortion. There are obvious things that if all of these parties got together on and joined with the trade unions and joined with left formations that are even less political, could have a huge movement and could then take on. I mean, we did that during the war in Vietnam. The civil rights movement did that. The labor movement, the women's movement. All of those movements, when they were able to coalesce and set aside some of their other differences around a central goal, a central battle, be it the right to organize a union or the right to not have a child if you don't want to have one, were successful. And we could do that again, but we can't do it if we're nitpicking each other about whether or not our total program of revolution is exactly the same as our sister organization's total program of revolution.
Jim, we're running out of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you if you could please tell our listeners how they could tune into your program, and secondly, how they can reach out to the People's Congress of Resistance.
Yeah. The Lawyers Guild showed that it broadcasts out of Los Angeles. It's live online at kpfk.org. kpfk.org. You can listen to it.
What time?
I'm sorry. It's every Wednesday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon Pacific Coast time. 2 o'clock Pacific Coast time, which is 5 o'clock here in New York. Tune in to kpfk.org, and you can listen to the Lawyers Guild show. Now, I will be off over the summer, I should say, because I'm not going to be in this country over the summer, so sadly I won't be able to do the show. And as far as the People's Congress is concerned, just People's Congress of Resistance.org, you'll be able to find out more about it, how you can register for it, and more of what it has in mind, and whether you might want to be a part of that or not.
Jim, it's so wonderful to have you here. We feel as though you belong with us.
I would love to do that. I would love to. We should figure out a way to do this coast to coast.
Right,
you
coast
know,
to coast.
We don't have to be in the same room to do this. We should do that more.
I like that.
I like it too. Thank you.
Deal.
Jim, have a good summer.
All right.
And thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Oh, my pleasure.
Really. See you in D.C. Arizona has long been ground zero for immigration controversies. It's a state with one of the harshest immigration laws in the country, Senate Bill 1070. In the capital of Phoenix, immigrant rights groups have dedicated the past two decades to fighting the notorious Sheriff Joe Arpaio, known for racial profiling, late-night raids, and a tent city outdoor prison. Arpaio was voted out of office in 2016. But the state still has its share of threats to civil rights. An anti-Muslim bigot and conspiracy theorist is being paid thousands of dollars in public funds to train Arizona police officers about the so-called jihadi threat in the U.S. Joining us for our Lawyers You'll Like segment is attorney Paul Gatone of Tucson, Arizona. A Chicago native, Paul has spent over two decades in Arizona as a criminal defense lawyer at the People's Law Center and now in private practice. A longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild, Paul's focus is in advancing and defending civil rights. He and his wife, Joy, also run a radical bookstore called Revolutionary Grounds. Paul Gatone, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate being on the show.
Paul, you've been practicing law, what we call people's law, in Arizona for over two decades. What are the kinds of civil rights cases that you take?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I consider both parts of my practice, the criminal defense and the civil rights, to be civil rights, because some of the worst violations of people's rights, you know, from racial, economic disparity issues, et cetera, take part in the criminal law arena. But on civil rights issues, so much of our practice is police misconduct, like on a daily basis, phone calls coming in, people that were stopped, people whose homes that were searched, people who are brutalized, people who had loved ones killed. It's just, it seems nonstop. So we've been doing, you know, mostly it's civil rights litigation all around police misconduct, although we do some prisoner cases, which is every day, you know, letters coming in from inmates with medical conditions and brutality issues. And I have a really interesting case going on for a transgender inmate. She got out in December. But if you can imagine the situation, she was not completely transitioned, but she had female hormones and breast implants and was put in a male facility. As you can imagine, it was the outcome was horrible for her, and we're in the process of litigating that case.
Paul, I'm curious, you're in Tucson. Does Tucson or any of the surrounding areas have a civilian review complaint board to help deal with police misconduct?
Well, the city of Tucson has what they call the Citizen Police Advisory and Review Board. Years and years ago, some of us in and out of the Lawyers Guild were pushing for civilian review. They put in place this ridiculous sort of civilian review board. And then we, you know, after a series of other incidents with the police, they put in what's supposed to be an independent police auditor. But that position is very, very limited. The most they can do is review the investigation that the police do, and then order, you know, ask them to investigate some more, but they can't subpoena records, they can't give out discipline, they can't do any of that. So there was actually just an article in the local paper saying, you know, comparing the review process, you know, like internal affairs and the civilian review board, and the vast majority, well, actually all of the complaints about police abuse, primarily excessive force, were unsubstantiated by the process that's in place now. So it's generally, you know, ineffective.
Do you have a lot of misuse of tasers there?
Yeah, there's been a number of cases about tasers. I mean, the ridiculous thing is that, you know, police have this new toy, so they like to use it. On this whole continuum of force thing, I think it's really problematic because the taser is supposed to be less than lethal. My understanding, it's supposed to be used if someone poses a threat to the officers or other people, but we find the tasers being used so often just to get compliance. If someone is reluctant to cooperate with the police, we had a case here where someone didn't want to give a blood sample in a DUI investigation, so they, you know, put the taser right up to his neck multiple times and shocked him. It's just, yeah. If they have a new toy, they play with it. And I don't believe they have any concept of really when it's supposed to be used.
Now, Paul, are you a familiar fixture and known to the local law enforcement for your work?
Yes. It's really funny because my office right now is basically right behind the main police station. And we moved just across the street from our old office in like November, and I see this one police lieutenant in a restaurant downtown, and I say, "Hey, I moved just behind you guys." And he says, "Yeah, we know." And I'm like, "Oh, for better or worse, yes. I'm somewhat of a local fixture with the police, and, you know, they know who I am, and, you know, if I fell into a crack in the earth, I think they would be perfectly happy, but, you know, that's not going to happen anytime soon.
No, we hope not.
No.
Look, tell us a little bit when Sheriff Joe Arpaio, unfortunately your state is kind of associated with him, who no longer is in office, but when he was around, did you mount any challenges to some of the things that he was doing, his crackdown on immigrants?
right? We got all sorts of cases out of Maricopa County for, you know, excessive force and, you know, horrendous conditions. It was really just horrendous situation with Arpaio. I mean, good thing that he has been finally voted out of office. The new sheriff of Maricopa County seems much more forward-thinking. He's doing away with the tent city and not going to do the immigration raids. But a lot of damage has been done, and even with the new sheriff in Maricopa County, you know, we're still undoing the damage from Arpaio, and we still have to remain vigilant. I don't think we can ever assume that anyone in law enforcement is going to, you know, completely abide by the law and protect the people's rights.
Tell us, how much were you involved, if at all, with the Occupy movement a few years back? Did you have occupiers and encampments around there?
We did. It was actually quite interesting. As far as arrests were concerned, the number of Occupy-related arrests in Tucson were only second to those in New York City.
No.
It was a real hotbed of Occupy activity. I mean, from night one I was there, well, from beforehand, the initial meeting to put together an Occupy movement took place in the bookstore that my wife and I owned, and we were involved pretty much from there. I mean, I was, for 6 weeks, I think I was out there every night monitoring the arrest. I mean, we had like over 700 citations issued, and it was pretty much myself and one other lawyer were doing all of the defense work. It was, I think, for the last 2 months of 2012, pretty much my practice involved just Occupy. It was really intense.
Yeah, I forgot how large that was. Do you think it was because of the nice weather? I'm not saying you don't have politics down there.
I just think, you know, we have, you know, we're a relatively progressive spot in a not-so-progressive state, and I think the university being there also helped. So, I mean, we had a really strong Occupy movement, such as it was, and, yeah, it was just recently that we got rid of the last of the tickets. They were just, like I said, it was just an insane amount of tickets here, over 700-plus. Citations. Yeah, as I said, it was second only to New York City.
Now, Paul, remind me, were there any allegations of police infiltration there during Occupy?
You know, I assume there was. It certainly had the feeling of it. And what was interesting to me is in disposing of all the tickets, you know, I represented almost everyone that went to court. I mean, some people ended up representing themselves, but it was fascinating to see that in monitoring the situation, people that had, you know, many, many tickets all of a sudden just gone and no record of their existence on the court files, as if there were a couple people who's, you know, didn't do anything, and then their citations just seemed to disappear. And so I don't know how that happens other than if there are plans.
Yes.
And they're going along with the arrest, and then nothing happens. So that was always my impression. There were a few people. You know, it's difficult with the type of movement it was, but people just come out of nowhere. And you know, that's how we want to build a movement. But it also, I think, opens itself up to, you know, a certain amount of infiltration. And there were quite a, you know, at least a couple of people that I assumed to be plants. But, you know, whether they did any real damage to the movement or not, is uncertain.
Yes, and I think you're right. The very nature of Occupy made it especially vulnerable to that.
Right.
I mean, in New York, I remember during the 2004 RNC, what we'd see is sort of high-profile, highly visible arrest in the middle of a crowd, and then some people who were quietly observing would see that the police took those individuals around the corner or, you know, into an alley and then just sort of let them go. So we know there were provocateurs. I want to ask you, switching gears, to your reactions to Trump's election. I wish I could have been with you when that happened.
I got to tell you, I was panicked. I mean, I felt just like, not that Hillary Clinton was wonderful, but I'm just like devastated by what happened, Trump getting into office. And you know, I keep trying to tell people it was white supremacy, you know, and they're like, no. You know, a couple people I know that have voted for Trump. I'm like, no, it was devastating for me because I feel like a couple of reasons. One is because the left just sort of disappeared in our organizing, right? And we, you know, allowed working class people to turn to this evil FOB that supposedly is a populist. But I don't think that that was really the issue. I think ultimately the issue was just white supremacy. People just like, look, we're going to put the white guy in because he's better than another person of color, right? I mean, Hillary Clinton was not a person of color, but I think it was so much racism to the Obama administration. You know, just so much pent-up racism that it was just horrible. And I got to tell you, it was, for the longest time, a couple of weeks, you know, I listened to the news, you know, just all day long. And for a couple of weeks, I couldn't listen to the radio because I'm like, I could not stand to hear President-elect Trump. And then after the inauguration, I couldn't stand for a while. You know, I refuse to acknowledge that this person is the president. It's ridiculous. And it's just horrendous. I mean, you know, hopefully it's going to wake up the left and we're going to get off our behinds and,
well,
you know, get some organizing done.
That's hopeful, Paul. I mean, I'm not so sure about that. I think, for my view, we need to wake up some of the Republicans who were up at the helm, because the recent developments with the firing of FBI Director James Comey, allegations that Trump actually told Comey to let the Mike Flynn investigation go. I mean, this is obstruction of justice that harks back to the Nixon days.
It's even worse because, I mean, you know, what I think people need to wake up to is they're consolidating power.
Right.
I mean, they're not replacing people in all of these positions because they want it to all come out of a handful of people in the White House.
Right. And the loyalists.
And that's what's frightening. And
as
horrendous as Trump is, I mean, there's even more evil people behind. I mean, Pence is, you know, I don't even want to get into it, you know, because he's truly the evil one, because, you know, he would put in place a, you know, government dominated by his particular brand of religion,
right?
And so Trump is an idiot, and he's an egotist and probably very mentally ill, but his stupidity is, you know, being used as a cover by these other folks for, you know, Bannon and those to really put in a system that none of us, I'm certain, want to live under.
I think that's right. I want to ask you, Paul, about your bookstore, Revolutionary Grounds. When did you found it, and what goes on there?
Well, my wife Joy and I, started this store in 2008, and my wife Joy Soler runs the bookstore on a day-to-day basis. I mean, it's pretty amazing. She has got the most amazing collection of books there. And, you know, I have to tell you something, that since the Trump election, the book sales is just like jumped. People seem just ready to learn about the resistance. So, you know, and in some sense, it's a very regular coffee shop. People come in, they study, but also you'd be amazed at how many meetings they're organizing meetings with different left groups, LGBT groups, queer rights groups. I mean, it's really quite amazing. On every Wednesday, we have a presentation called Ideas for Change, and it's, you know, different issues, progressive, international, local issues. Tonight, a local Palestinian activist is going to be reporting on the hunger strikes, ongoing hunger strikes of Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli prisons. So it's really quite exciting, and the community support has been great for a small store. And, you know, Joy has really worked, you know, working hard to keep it going. We look at it more as like a community center, right? And an asset to the community, and people have really responded as well.
Paul, that's really, really wonderful. I remember when you were starting this, and I'm thrilled to hear how well it's going. Let me ask you this. Do you think you are a target because of the work you do and the bookstore you run?
Well, we think so. But, you know, in some sense, that being a target has backfired on the people that would target us. I mean, it was interesting when we first opened the store, a local right-wing radio host had encouraged his viewers to go shoot out the windows of our store. I mean, obviously that has never happened, and it just, increases our importance to the community, and people have rallied around those. I mean, just last weekend, we were getting trolled. Our Facebook site was getting trolled by some right-wing people who were, like, putting bad reviews on Facebook. It was just ridiculous, you know, in an effort, you know, just like giving us 1 star out of 5 and saying really ridiculous things like not enough helicopter rides for starving peasants, just ridiculous things. And so we put out a call on Facebook for people to, you know, give us likes and good reviews, and probably got like 50. So it was really amazing. Right. You know, any efforts to target the store has really sort of backfired.
So the store's 10-year anniversary is next year. I hope you're going to have a big celebration.
Well, that's the goal. I mean, you know, every day is sort of a struggle to keep it going. But, you know, my wife, Joy, just does an amazing job and puts pretty much all her effort into it. And, you know, we're keeping it going.
In our few remaining minutes, Paul, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. I've known you a long time through the National Lawyers Guild. I know that you were very close to Arthur Conoy, who was also a hero of mine. Tell us, what motivates you every day, and who are some of your legal heroes?
Well, I mean, as you said, Arthur Conoy was always a great hero of mine. I mean, there were so many people within the Lawyers Guild that, you know, kept me inspired, you know, especially people that on a day-to-day basis just keep struggling. You know, they go to the office, they represent clients, they go to court, they represent clients. I mean, that's what has always inspired me. And actually, I'm inspired on a daily basis by the clients, because there's just so much need out there. And, you know, I went to court on, what was the last holiday? I can't remember. Oh, late May Day. I couldn't take off May Day to go march. As I walk into the federal courthouse, the one guard says, "Hey, counselor, why aren't you out marching? It's May Day." And I responded, "Well, I'd love to, but the oppressive capitalist legal system doesn't give my clients a break, so I got to be here too." And he's like, "Oh." He didn't know what to say after that. I'm like, you know, I would have loved to have gone out march, but unfortunately my clients are hauled into court, so I got to go there too. So, I mean, I think what inspires me is that just people keep fighting, right? It's just people, you know, average folks just out there fighting. And so I got to keep going. As long as my clients are hauled into court, and as long as they're getting abused by the police, I got to keep going.
Before we ask you how listeners can learn more about you or the bookstore, I want to know what advice you might dispense to young lawyers, newly admitted attorneys, and law students who want to practice what we fondly call people's law, but who might be nervous that they can't make a living doing it, or, you know, it's unpopular in this conservative climate. What would you say to them?
Well, you know, when I started out practicing law, I had started a nonprofit law office in Southern Arizona People's Law Center, and it gave me a great outlet to, you know, we did tenants' rights, community organizing around tenants' issues and, you know, homeless rights. I mean, that was, I can't say that that would work for everyone if it's a possibility to start a nonprofit and get some funding, but I do say for people that want to get out into people's law, that want to do the fight, just do it. Just go out. There are offices out there that hire folks, you know, progressive law offices, even start off as a public defender, getting some experience and getting, you know, learning about the realities of the system, or, you know, find some other lawyers that share your interest and go into a private practice. I mean, one of the ways after I left the People's Law Center that I was able to do what I wanted to do is I did some, you know, some criminal defense, some civil rights, and I find it to be all very political. I mean, there aren't any cases I do on a day-to-day basis that I'm not happy about taking. So, you know, and I think you also have to, it's difficult because I know there's so much debt that students take on, and, you know, it's really difficult to tell people, you know, go out and try to work a low-paying job, but it's just the reality of the situation. It's just, you know, don't give up. I discourage people from saying, oh, I'm going to go work in a big firm for a while, and then I'm going to go out and do progressive law. I think that that is a waste of your talent and your ability. I think the most encouragement I could give is find other lawyers that agree with you or other recent law graduates. You know, get yourself a little space and start doing progressive law, taking civil rights cases, take criminal defense cases. You can make it work.
I think that's right. A lot of our colleagues at the National Lawyers Guild did exactly that and have rewarding and viable practices.
Right.
Paul, we're running out of time. How can our listeners learn more about you or the bookstore, Revolutionary Grounds?
Well, they can always check my website out at CatoneCivilRightsLaw.com, or if they'd like to contact me, I'm still on AOL, pgatone@AOL.com, and check out Revolutionary Grounds is on Facebook or RevolutionaryGrounds.com. We also have a website so they can learn about the bookstore, or if they want to contact The bookstore directly, it's revolutionarygrounds at gmail.com.
Perfect. Paul, best of luck to you. Big hugs, and thank you for joining us.
All right, thank you, and power to the people.
Power to the people.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.